Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spent on Moto, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
E-books. Hello and welcome back to Epochs. Over the last couple of episodes, I've talked about Special Forces raids and once or twice before, and people seem to like that. So I'm going to continue that, do a few more of those before I move on to something entirely different. This time I thought I would talk about a very, very, very famous World War II raid. It's not the SAS. It's Commandos, though. It's British Special Forces Commandos, but not actually the SAS, in Europe. And among military history people, it's very, very well known and famous. But I think among the rest of the world, it's not particularly famous. So I hope that I'm actually bringing it to a few of you for the first time ever. That's nice. I'm certainly going to tell the story as though you've never heard it before. And it's the story of the raid on a place called Saint-Nazaire. Okay, so let's give a bit of background before I start doing reading. I plan to do a lot of reading this episode. Maybe the majority of it will be reading, because I've got a great account of it, which just tells the story kind of perfectly, in my opinion. But I'll still interrupt myself a bit. But before I start the reading, I'll give you sort of an overview of what it is. It's World War II. Okay, we're deep in World War II. Nazi-occupied France. All of France is completely occupied. Well, there's the Vichy French, but effectively France is occupied. Now, there's a battle for the Atlantic. Who controls the Atlantic? And the Germans have got a very small number of giant battleships. The Tirpitz is the big one. Another is the Scharnhorst. A couple of giant battleships where they're sort of the biggest, most powerful battleships of the day. And we, the Allies, both the British and the Americans, but more the British really, are sort of kind of terrified of the Tirpitz and the Scharnhorst. They're worried that in any sort of one-on-one situation, we just lose. Or if the Tirpitz intercepts a convoy of, you know, like smaller destroyers that are supposed to be escorting merchant shipping, the Tirpitz just wipes out everyone on the horizon. It just wipes out everyone. That's how scary the battleship Tirpitz was. Incidentally, it ended up doing no such thing, but that was the fear. That was the worry. Okay. Now, it was so big that there was literally only one place on the whole Atlantic seaboard, the European Atlantic seaboard, one place where it could possibly ever come in to any sort of dry dock for, you know, maintenance, overhauling, upgrades, anything like that. There was one dry dock big enough for it. And that was in a place called Saint-Nazaire in Normandy. Now, if anyone knows the map of Normandy, you know about D-Day. There's the northern stretch of Normandy in the Channel, in the English Channel. But of course, Normandy stretches round, turns the corner, and then there's a whole Atlantic coast bit of Normandy. And the Loire River runs out into the Atlantic Ocean there. I'll show a map so everyone can see exactly what I'm talking about. And there is a deep water port of Saint-Nazaire. Right on the Atlantic coast of Normandy, the Loire estuary. And that's where there was loads and loads of things there the Germans had. They had not just this giant dry dock, which was absolutely vital to them, but they also had loads of submarine pens, really, really, really heavily guarded submarine pens with giant concrete ceilings that bombs couldn't burst through. And, you know, the German U-boats, the German submarines were causing absolute havoc in the Atlantic. We didn't, you know, they were sort of winning the war in the Atlantic, depending on how you look at it and who you believe and stuff. But there was certainly a worry. There's no two ways about that. There was a worry. So from the Allies' point of view, in Churchill's mind, if he could wipe those U-boat pens and the dry dock off the map, if he could destroy them, that would be brilliant. That would be a massive, massive advantage to us. It's sort of not just like a nice advantage. It's of key importance to him at that point in the war. Like that's sort of a strategic goal for him. Okay, but it was difficult, very, very difficult to just bomb it flat because, well, a couple of reasons. One of the main reasons is that the Germans had massively, massively defended it. Giant amounts of anti-aircraft guns and artillery, you know, a giant garrison of 5,000-6,000 men. It would be difficult to, it was sort of not possible for a couple of different reasons, not practicable to destroy it all from the air at this point in the war. It'd also be kind of impossible, or very, very difficult, certainly, very, very costly, to launch a large, big invasion force, tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of men, you know, in thousands and thousands of land aircraft, like D-Day or whatever, you know, something like on that level. That was also probably not a very good idea for a number of reasons, that the Germans controlled the German U-boats controlled the waters. The waters were heavily mined. The whole area was heavily, heavily defended by the Germans. It would have been a bloodbath, a terrible, terrible bloodbath to attempt that. And yet, right, it's one of Churchill's key aims. So what they decide to do is launch a raid, a commando raid. Small number of very, very committed men going in under the cover of darkness, using a little bit of stealth and sleight of hand, as it were, to try and get in there and blow the stuff up commando style. So that's what it is. It's known as one of the greatest raids of World War II from the Allies' point of view. It involves a ship ramming, a giant bomb, a 4-ton-plus bomb, and daring do, bloody adventure by the commandos. And, you know, lots of men lose their lives and are imprisoned, you know, captured. And it's just a big raid. It's much bigger than anything else I've talked about before, right? It's a few hundred commandos, not just a few dozen. So for commando stuff, it's quite a big, well, it is a big raid. Okay, so I'll let the account I've got here tell the story. It's by a chap called Adolphe Leportier, a Frenchman. And obviously it takes place in France. He's a French admiral, I believe. And he tells the story very well, so I'll do a whole bunch of reading for this episode, mainly reading. All right, so settle in. Hope you enjoy. The Saint-Nazaire Commandos. The assault by the British Army Commandos on the port of Saint-Nazaire on the occupied Atlantic coast of France is widely considered to be the greatest seaborne raid of World War II. The port, which lies at the mouth of the Loire, had been a major target for the British from the time of the German occupation. Not only did it contain the largest dry dock in the world, thus the only one which could facilitate the gigantic German battleships, Tirpitz and Scharnhorst, it was also an important U-boat base in the Battle of the Atlantic. A major target, but not an easy one. Saint-Nazaire was outside the range of most RAF bombers and was heavily defended by the 28 heavy guns of the German 280th Naval Atlantic Battalion, plus a battery of railway-mounted 240mm guns at La Bulle, 7 miles inland. The port also bristled with anti-aircraft artillery and was serviced by 6,000 German personnel. Moreover, the dry dock itself, which had to be destroyed for any raid to be considered successful, had an outer caisson wall of steel, some 35 feet thick. So, insanely thick is what that means. In the commandos' raid on Saint-Nazaire, they were accompanied by the Royal Navy escort destroyers Athelstone and Tyndale. 16 motor launches, very small wooden sort of kind of rickety boats, really, motor launches, a motor torpedo boat and a motor gunboat. Not much, in other words, not a great deal of firepower to shoot back at the Germans. To break the caisson of the Normandy dock, an old destroyer, HMS Campbelltown, was packed with 4.25 tons of high explosive and a time-delay pencil fuse to be delivered by head-on ramming. This account of Operation Chariot is by the French admiral and military historian Adolphe Leportier. It begins with the British flotilla approaching the French coast on the night of the 27th of March 1942. Okay, so now these are Leportier's words. The hours passed and night drew nearer. The occupied coast was no longer far away, and the enemy had not yet given any sign of life. For the men whose nerves were keyed up, this seemed incredible, and their morale rose proportionately. The Tyndale had obviously been quite right about her submarine. it was learned later that this submarine had not sunk and signalled effectively that it had been attacked by two destroyers sailing on a southwesterly course. As a last precaution, the course of the formation was maintained in the direction of La Palice, a place, La Palice, until nightfall, so that should an enemy plane appear, it would still be mistaken about the destination of this unusual task force. Nevertheless, said Ryder, when night fell, we all felt immensely relieved. At 20:00 hours, 8 in the evening, 7 miles southeast of Saint-Nazaire, Atherstone slipped the motor gunboat, and Ryder, Newman, and their small staff got into the small boat, which got underway to accompanying cheers from the crew. Don't forget I have been a good father to you, signalled Atherstone. The Campbelltown also slipped the motor torpedo boat, which after a few cavortings took her place in the queue. During this time, the remaining motor launches took up their position in the assault formation, with the motor gunboat ahead. Behind her came the Campbelltown, and astern and on the flanks, the leading motorboats of the two columns. The Tyndall and Atherstone took up their positions provisionally about a mile apart to increase their chances of finding the submarine HMS Sturgeon, which had taken up a position by day 40 miles southwest of Saint-Nazaire to act as marker. It had to show a discreet light directed southwest. Then we get told a little bit about how one of the motor launches got a little bit of damage to one of its engines, and they had to put a load of the men from that particular motor launch, which is a relatively small boat and motor launch, and transfer them to one of the other ones, which was now really packed, as you can imagine, and basically just leave that motor launch boat, which had a problem with its engine, just leave it to fend for itself and try and get back. Just forget about it. We've got to push on to do the actual raid itself. We can't think about that anymore. So they sort of leave it. Okay, the portier goes on and says, the lights of various fishing boats appeared on both bows. Ryder thought this was proof that the enemy had not got wind of the attack. This encounter also seemed to him a piece of luck, for the enemy radar would find it difficult to distinguish the suspicious echoes among all the normal ones given by the fishing boats of a type and volume similar to those of the motor torpedo boat. Towards midnight, they saw gun flashes in the distance in the direction of Saint-Nazaire. As they approached nearer, they could make out the classic pattern of flak, searchlight beams, and firework display of shells and luminous tracers crossing each other in the sky. This evidence of the presence of friendly aircraft at the promised hour was very comforting. As they approached the Châtelier buoy, one of those things floating in the water, they began to make out the coast to port on their left-hand side. The Campbelltown received the order to set course at 50 degrees and to guide the formation, for in order to use her rudimentary radar, those transmitting and receiving beams are set to fore and aft. The motor gun boat would be obliged to manoeuvre constantly while taking the bearings. At the same time, however, she zigzagged to make soundings in front of the columns. On the fluorescent radar screen, the luminous teeth of the, quote, pipes, quote, appeared and disappeared. According to the evolution of the boat, each time it set its course on some protruding object, a very much larger pipe appeared when it headed to port, their course allowing them to pinpoint this obstacle, and at 25 minutes past one in the morning, they would distinguish the big Mores Tower 400 yards away to the north. After 33 hours of navigation, because they'd left from Cornwall, by the way, they'd come all across, all the way from Cornwall, which is, you know, quite a long, well, 33 hours it took them. It's quite a long way, really, isn't it? None of these ships move particularly fast. After 33 hours of navigation, out of sight of land, the British ships had arrived exactly at their fixed point, despite changes of course and the variable currents met with on the way. Their meeting with Sturgeon was another example of the precision of this navigation. That's the summary. So they're ready to go. This was the moment when the excitement reached its climax. They were nearing the target. It seemed more and more improbable that the Germans wouldn't realise that 18 enemy ships were entering a roadstead where they had concentrated every conceivable weapon of outlook, detection and defence. They wondered if this indifference, because the Germans hadn't fired on them, they're starting to approach and the Germans aren't firing on them. It's dark, it's at night. Well, as we said, it's nearly 1:30 in the morning. And these ships that really shouldn't be there, as far as the Germans are concerned, shouldn't be there. They can expect to be fired on and the Germans aren't firing on them yet. They wondered, the Brits, the commandos, they wondered if this indifference were merely a ruse or whether they intended to let them come close before crushing them at one blow. For the Campbelltown, you know, the boat with the giant bomb on it, there was an additional worry. Was there enough water for her to pass over the Minden sandbank? Suddenly, all the men on the bridge looked at each other anxiously. By a vibration of the hull beneath their feet, which could deceive no sailor, they realised that the destroyer had touched bottom. Would she get across? There's the sandbank, you see. They bent anxiously over the side to gauge the slowing down of the wake. Their speed seemed constant. Another jolt, another anxious moment. They had made it. Their mates in the motor launches did not know that a few inches less water and the Campbelltown would have been stopped for a good few hundred yards from the goal, even before the enemy had intervened. But could the Germans wait much longer? Nerves were keyed up to breaking point, waiting for what would happen from one minute to the next. What form would it take? At that moment, the sky was entirely covered by low cloud, through which the moonlight hardly trickled. You know, perfect for us, as dark as possible. The darker the better. White wisps of mist floated across from time to time. On board the motor gunboat, they could already make out the dark lines of the outer harbour, just as 24 years before, the men on the Vindictive, a ship called the Vindictive, had seen the Zeebrugge mole a few seconds before the battle began. Suddenly, the narrow beam of a searchlight from the bank lit up the roadstead. The strip of light fell astern of the flotilla. For a few seconds, while several hundred men held their breath, it moved slowly and drew near to the rear motorboats. A moment before it reached them, it went out. Was it possible that once more the enemy had let slip the opportunity of discovering the attackers? They did not have to wait long for the answer. Less than a minute later, all the searchlights of the two banks went up simultaneously, focused on the roadstead, which was suddenly lit up as bright as day. The roadstead is a bit confusing, but the way ahead, the path that the Allied boats are going to take. Despite the dark, dull paint of the hulls, all the boats were visible at once by the silver foam and their wakes. In 10 minutes, the Campbelltown would have reached the target unless she suffered some major damage. So still 10 minutes out. The idea, by the way, is that the Campbelltown with a giant bomb in it is going to ram this 35 feet thick steel caisson wall of that dry dock, the giant dry dock that the giant Nazi battleships will need. It's going to ram that, the wall of that, and hopefully, you know, the giant bomb will blow up, destroy that wall, the caisson wall of the dry dock, and flood it, destroy it. You know, it will take ages and ages and ages to repair. Maybe it can't be repaired, sort of a thing. That's the idea. And so the Campbelltown is still 10 minutes out from there, which is a lifetime, you know, if the Germans decide they're going to open up everything they've got on it at kind of point-blank range. And also, there's a few hundred commandos. So the idea was that they would do that. The Campbelltown with the giant bomb will do that for the dry dock. Also, they'll disgorge a few hundred, what is it, over 300, 350 odd more, slightly more, commandos to just run amok in Saint-Nazaire, try and kill as many Germans as they can, try and blow up the U-boat pens, just try and take out as many gun emplacements as they can, just cause classic commando raid, cause as much chaos and devastation as they can. Okay, but the Campbelltown's still 10 minutes out, so a lifetime. Each of the commanding officers ordered full speed ahead. You know, like the Germans have turned the searchlights on. You may as well just sprint now. It's all or nothing. They've seen you. They've definitely seen you. Any idea of being sneaky and covert and not being noticed, that's done with now. So just full steam ahead, ramming speed. They had to start at once now, trying to delay the enemy from opening fire. Once there was no longer any question of concealing the approach of the ships, they must try and fox the defences by trying to deceive them out of their nationality, because they made a sort of a half-assed effort to paint the ships as German ships. But it was sort of a last-minute thing, and it's clearly not a German ship by design. The Germans will know what their ships look like and what a World War One American-built ship looks like. It's clearly not a German ship, right? It's not going to fool them for very long, if at all. It was with this in view that the Campbelltown had been given the shape of a German destroyer of the identical class of those signalled that very day at sea off Saint-Nazaire. I mean, again, it's not actually going to fool them for long. Anyone that knows what they're looking at. International law forbids hiding under an enemy flag at the moment of opening fire. Oh, so that's the thing. They put like the German flag on the ship, right? Painted it the right colours, put a flag on it. But you can't actually, well, according to international law, can't actually start firing on the Germans with that flag up. So he's told here, the British hoisted white ensigns, tattered and blackened by smoke and spray, flags which a yeoman of signals would have considered unserviceable, even for stormy weather. The little signal searchlight of a coastal battery spelt out its recognition letters in Morse. The British ignored them. Leading yeoman Pike of the motor gunboat replied at first by illegible flashes, and to another searchlight at the entrance of the harbour, which questioned in turn, he transmitted the letters which the battery had given. A few shots were fired sporadically over their bows. This was the moment to play the last card. Go ahead, Pike. Pike, who knew how to transmit in German, signalled to his unknown interrogator. Wait. This is all done with lights. So the Germans, obviously, are right on the cusp of realising. In fact, obviously, one or two of them have. But they're right on the cusp of like, wait, what's going on? Something's happening. Do we fire on them? What do we do? They're right at that moment. Like, these aren't our guys. Oh, my God. It's not German stuff. And so one of our signal guys just says, wait. Just the last ditch attempt to stop them for even a few seconds more. Then this Pike gave them the indication known to the English of a German destroyer, followed by a long message in German, preceded by the word urgent. And this is what the message was supposed to have said. Two vessels damaged in the course of an engagement with the enemy. Request entrance to the port immediately. So we're just completely bluffing, completely and utterly bluffing them. He finished by the signal, which meant I still have something else to transmit. You know, just saying anything to stop them from completely opening fire. He was about to send a message to his other interrogator when the light batteries of the port opened fire more strongly. Yeah, the Germans just, you know, didn't really buy it. They've got eyeballs. They can see that there's something not right. Completely and utterly not right. Okay, so the light batteries of the port opened fire more strongly, although still hesitatingly. Taking his most powerful Aldis lamp, Pike slowly flashed the letters of the international signal code, which meant, I am a friend, you are mistaken. The firing ceased again. In another 6 minutes, the Campbelltown would have reached the lock gate, the ultimate goal. They want to blow up with that giant bomb. Her chances improved considerably with each second gained. The British knew that on the quays, there were light cannon and machine guns and 40mm guns on Minden Point. The heavy coastal batteries could not fire so near the port. It would therefore need a really unlucky shot to stop the destroyer now. At last, the Germans understood what was up. The storm broke loose. The only thing to do was to reply as best they could. And the leaping curves of the multicoloured tracers crossed each other between the banks and the ships with their powerful wakes. At that moment, the motor gunboat passed a German armed trawler anchored just opposite the southern entrance. She gave it a few bursts from her pom-pom, and all the British ships astern followed suit as they passed the unfortunate vessel. As she dominated the motor launches by her height, the German batteries, in turn, taking her for a target, finished by sinking her. The battle was an unequal one between the British crews in the open, lit up by searchlights on the deck, and their wooden motor launches, loaded with petrol, and the German artillery, comfortably installed behind the concrete walls of their pillboxes, hidden in the shadow of the quays and the buildings. However, the accurate fire from the sea slowed down the fire on land. It must also be mentioned that as they approached the Vielle Entrée, the ships could concentrate their fire on the batteries surrounding it, while the other German coastal defences could no longer intervene. We hope you enjoyed that video, and if you did, please head over to lotuseaters.com for the full unabridged video.
Moro Casino, America. America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.